This is the interview featuring Brian Brushwood. Call Brian a magician's magician. He knows every trick, every angle, and has hosted shows on the subject. He's also an accomplished podcaster and all-around good guy. Not too much of an intro here because the interview's long and we cover a lot of ground. Enjoy this interview with Brian Brushwood. You've been described as a magician, an author, a podcaster, blah, blah, blah. You got a lot of titles. What do you call yourself?
You know what? If you asked me 5 years ago, the answer would have been incredibly simple. It's like I'm a touring stage magician who performs at colleges all over the United States. But nowadays, it's complicated and frustrating because I honestly don't know myself. It's, you know, I don't know. I host a comedy podcast with Justin Robert Young that won Best Video Podcast, Best Mature Podcast. We have a couple of number one Billboard comedy albums. We have separately, you know, Scam School is a show all about social engineering at the bar and on the street. It's all about how to, you know, do tricks to fool your friends. And we crossed a million subscribers. And also I host a TV show on National Geographic called Hacking the System. I don't know. It's weird. I just feel like I'm just, I don't know, shouting out awards I won.
Well, by the way, congratulations on all your awards. Well deserved. You know what's interesting though is I think that you bring up a really interesting point. Do you remember back in the good old days when you would as a celebrity, as an entertainer, you're an entertainer. As an entertainer, right? You would have one discipline and you would do that. If you were a touring magician, you'd be a touring magician and you would tour and tour and tour. As a comic, same thing, right? But that's not the model anymore.
Well, it's everything you said is 100% correct for most of the people. There were a few people who would break out of that brand. For example, you know, like David Letterman or whatever, you know, or Conan O'Brien would be a touring comic. However, they could break out into becoming a talk show host or whatever. But those were few and far between. Nowadays, though, the fact that there's zero barriers to entry. Every single person who is a touring musician, every single person who is a touring comedian, every single person who is a touring juggler or whatever should and can and does have their own podcast, right? They have their own platform. They have their own way to reach out to people who really dig what they're about. And I would say that is very much a I don't know, like a residual reverberation of the time we live in, less than our, you know, the fact that we're all magnificent nowadays.
That's so true. Let's see. Wait a minute. So your first TV appearance was on Roseanne. Is that true? In 2000?
Yeah. Holy cow. Most people, I would say probably 99% of the people listening right now do not remember that for about 20 minutes in the late 90s, Roseanne, formerly Roseanne Barr,
right.
I don't know what she calls herself now, had a talk show.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, my first TV appearance. It was like, you know, I quit my day job. I'm like, hey, man, I'm going to tour around and do a crazy punk rock magic show. So I stuffed a bunch of VHS tapes into tubs of atomic fireballs. And I put signs on the side that said, think this is hot, try eating fire. Brian Brushwood eats fire and does a bunch of other stuff. And I spent $300 shipping them out to all these TV shows. And then and Roseanne was the first to respond, or her team. But it was what's really, really weird is coming into an environment where everybody knows this project is about to be canceled. And some contingent of the audience maybe is not thrilled with the host. And so they booked me for it. And they're like, yeah, do your crazy thing where you stick a nail in one eye and pop it out the other eye. That'll be great. It'll be great. And then you get there and it's not until after I did my appearance that it became clear that Roseanne Barr / Arnold was not cool with stuff coming out of eyes into her hand. Like, she's a crazy ass germaphobe. And I don't want to say that I was the butt of a joke or the instrument in a joke, but all I'm going to say is that's not the kind of booking that you do when everybody's on board and really thrilled with how stuff is going. Amazingly, though, like, I was thrilled. I was like, hey, look at me. I'm on national television. We'll see. So I come home and I was like, well, let me tune in to watch myself on TV. And it turns out that Roseanne at the time had that sweet, sweet very highly valued spot of after the infomercials from midnight to 1 p.m. or 1 a.m., but before Doppler weather radar at 1:30 from the rest of the night. So I tuned in at 1 in the morning to watch myself, along with five other people in Austin, have my national TV debut.
So you had a remarkable lead-in and lead-out, as they say in the biz.
I mean, look, there's a lot of people who need ShamWows, and there's a lot of people who want to know what the weather's like today.
Okay, but listen, you got a great story out of it. And by the way, at the time – okay, so now get in the Wayback Machine, right, and go back 15 years to April of 2000. People were not putting a nail in one eye and out the other on TV.
Yeah, and I don't want to take anything away from that, but it's like once you do a thing, you kind of become less impressed with it, where it's like to me as a kid, seeing someone eat fire was magic. This is somebody showing mastery over the elements. Watching somebody hammer a 4.5-inch nail up in his face is magic. It's like that's not possible. This guy's a wizard or whatever. But then you do those things yourself and you find this weird deflated like, whatever. Yeah, no, I can hammer a nail in my face. I can eat fire. I can stick a nail in an eye when I pop it out the other. Whatever.
And so your response to this was to destroy the illusion for everyone else.
No. I mean that's not my intention.
No, I get it, but like
it's just, you know my goal in this moment is to express what it's like to be in that situation. And it's like the moment you do anything, no matter what it is, whether it's walking across a tightrope, whether it's walking across hot coals or whatever, the moment you've done it, unfortunately, you become what you wanted to be, and you also let go of the fantasy of what it would be like to be that thing is. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense, but I love this too because that's where Scam School comes in. So on National Geographic, right?
Well, Scam School is part of the Discovery family. It's
okay.
Scam School. I'm sorry. If you just search Scam School, you'll see it. It's all online. It's all on YouTube and Test Tube and so on. But Scam School, we call it the show about social engineering at the bar and on the street. It's all about how to win free drinks, how to get the girl's phone number, how to become the most popular person in the room, and using magic trickery and clever puzzles that hopefully will make you look like the smartest person in the room.
But it's – you know what's funny too? It's so simple. You talk about open-face poker, right? It was one of the most more recent ones.
Sub poker is what we called it.
Yeah, and it's – I'm not going to tell people how to do it. Don't tell people how to – go to YouTube, look it up. It's very simple though. But it's a simple concept that's not – there's nothing magical about it. It's very, very simple to do, and I would say 99% of the people will fall for this every single time.
Absolutely. Well, the thing about face-up poker is that it doesn't rely on perceptual trickery or whatever. It relies on intellectual trickery, I guess, where it's like Teller from Penn & Teller once wrote me that the best way to kill at a magic trick is to surprise me. And the way he phrased it, I loved. He says, put two and two in front of me, convince me it's five, and then reveal the truth. Four and blow me away. Face-up poker is very much that. It is a case where all of the rules are laid out in front of you. You both do the dance one way and of course the other person wins. But then you play the exact same game, the exact same dance, but you do something utterly nonsensical, something that makes no sense whatsoever. And then only at the end do you reveal that everything was part of a master plan and that's why you're on top.
So back up 1 second for me, if you would, okay?
Sure.
You talk about the letter that Teller wrote you. The story goes deeper. So you wrote him a letter when you were, what, 19?
Oh, geez. Okay, so I met Teller when I was 19 years old, and this is how enchanted I was with Penn & Teller. Understand that when I was in second grade, I watched Penn & Teller's first PBS special, and I was blown away. I was like, I had seen magic be impressive, amazing, enchanting, all of those things. I had never seen magic be punk rock and cool. I had never seen somebody get on screen, look me in the eye and say, you are going to have a taste of the magic and give that to us. And that's what Penn & Teller did. And so by the time I got into magic in high school, I guess really college, I came out and I saw them at an event in Houston, Texas. And I remember my buddy Gordon made a joke like, hey, I'm going to have them sign my three of clubs to my bastard son. And I was like, oh, you should totally do that. He's like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm too scared. I was like, well, dude, you just going to leave that there, then screw it. I'll totally do that. And so I went up and I asked him that, and he laughed, and we had a casual conversation. And I remember saying, and understand, it was 1993, 94. And I said, do you have this thing called email? Because I would like to write you on email. And he said, oh, well, you know, I haven't picked a provider yet. So why don't you give me your email address and I'll contact you. And I remember at the time thinking, this is the classiest way to shoot me down I've ever experienced. Thank you, Teller, for being so classy as to pretend like you care about my email. And sure enough, like 6 months later, I start getting emails from Teller. And it's very obviously me on a, you know, mail serve list or whatever, one of many that he is writing to. But then I realized, oh, my God, I have Teller's email address. I could say whatever I want to him.
Yeah, that's before people realize that you don't give your email address to everyone because you're going to get spammed for the rest of your life.
Bada bing bang, right?
Yeah.
So I decide, I want to express to Teller, you know, I want to ask him for advice. And I wrote like three or four drafts of this initial stuff. And eventually what happened, you know, I threw them all away. And then eventually I had some, I forget what it was, some homework assignment that I was just annoyed, some letter I didn't want to write or whatever. And I was like, screw it. I'm pissed off. Now's the perfect time to reach out to Teller. And so I wrote him basically the title was Fury. And I went on to talk about like, hey, Teller, you're great. And that's great and whatever. But the fact is, I'm furious at you, not for being wonderful or brilliant or original, which are all those things. But I'm furious at you because you got there first. And because you're there first, anything I do that is in tribute or service to what you have established will look like a pale shadow, an imitation of what you are. And I'm pissed off about that. Any advice, Brian? And then
that's awesome.
And so, you know, just writing the letter was totally cathartic. I was like, okay, good. I got that out of my system. I can go to bed. And the next morning I got up and of course there's a response from Teller. And number one, I thought there was a 0% chance that this dude would have any idea who I was or what my story was. And instead the opening line I remember so clearly said, my dear bastard son, it's about to and I was like, shut up. And what followed was this 4.5-page epic essay on the nature of creativity, on what it means to discover what art is inside you, about what it means to work outside of your discipline. In it, he goes on to say, like, I should have been an editor. That's what makes me a great magician. He says, Michelangelo should have been a director. That's what makes him a great artist. And, you know, just this mind-blowing stuff. And he talks about the nature of what it means to quit your day job and all this stuff. And it was as though tablets had come down from the mountain on high. And it ultimately ended up defining my entire career.
That's amazing. Here's what I find amazing. First of all, that someone like him, because at the time they're at the pinnacle, right? They're at the peak of their popularity at this time.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and that he took the time. First of all, that he remembered you is remarkable. Obviously, you made an impact on him in some way, shape, or form. But that he took the time to impart all of this wisdom on you. I mean, I can now see. It's funny because when I was doing a little bit of research, what I had was that you wrote Teller a letter at 19 and that he responded back. And I was going to ask you, why was the response so important to you? But now I get it. That's so cool.
Well, and plus also, like, here's the weird part. Here's the part that blows my mind. I went back and reread this letter recently. At the time I wrote it, I was, I think, 20 years old and Teller was 47. And I know he's 47 because he says so in the letter. As somebody who recently turned 40, who recently did his own television show, who has, you know, Scam School, which is arguably, you know, the number one way that anyone under 20 is learning their magic tricks nowadays.
Right.
All of a sudden I realize I'm on the other side of that stuff. And I get these emails from you know, 15-year-olds, from 12-year-olds, from even 8-year-olds. And it's like, all I remember is how much it meant to me that Teller wrote me back every single time I wrote him. And as a result, I find myself, I don't want to say burdened, but it's like, it is an absolute necessity for me as a grown-up adult to behave as grown-up adults who I respected, you know, did to me. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. Now, here's the question. So knowing your story and knowing that there are people, there are millennials out there who want to be the next Brian Brushwood, do you get emails? Do you get, because now anyone can email, anyone can tweet you. Yeah, it's just easy to reach you, right? Do you get those kinds of requests from other people?
Oh, absolutely. And all of them think they're super clever for saying, "Ha, I'm your bastard son." Right. I was like, look, I'm the one who wrote that bit. And by the way, when I say I wrote it, I mean I stole it from my friend Gordon. I mean, it's like, but having said that, you know, everybody is clearly coming from a place of like sincere wanting to learn. You know, they have the student mindset and they're hoping to figure out, you know, what secret sauce I have for them. And it's a lot of work. I would say an hour to 2 hours every day I spend. Number one, I extend it. It's not just emails. You know, emails, I do my best to respond to everyone. But tweets, I respond to everyone. And here's the thing nobody does on YouTube is I respond to every sincere comment on all of YouTube. Now, granted, you know, half of them are like, you know, your hair's stupid, I hate you, this guy tries too hard or whatever. But it's like I respond to every single one I'm able to.
That is remarkable. But, you know, I mean, listen, at the same time, the way things are now is anyone can hide behind a computer and say something, you know, to try to bring the project down.
Yeah.
What would you say the ratio is positive to negative?
Man, that's a really good question.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
Here's the thing is in our emotions, in our feelings, I would say that most of us feel as though negative is 80%, but truthfully, I think that the negative is like 20%. I think that the negative resonates with us louder because it sounds like the negative voice in our heads. But truthfully, I think that this is the burden and the curse of being somebody who creates something on the internet and puts it out there, is that you will hear 99 compliments about how creative, original, and well executed it is, but you will discount all of them. And all you'll pay attention to is the one person who says your hair is dumb. And then then this is what's wrong with all of us, is that we write that person and be like, when you say dumb, do you mean like it's not very intelligent? Because I'll agree with you on that. But if you mean like I look bad, then let's talk about it so we can work things out or whatever. I don't know. It's we're all so broken on the inside, and that's fine.
That's the happy takeaway.
We're all broken, and that's great. That's the happy takeaway. Put that on my tombstone.
There you go. I think it's interesting too, not just how people get to where they are, but sort of how they get to where they are. If I got any of this mixed up, tell me. You went to UT, University of Texas.
Yep.
You went to work for Dell after that, which is based in Round Rock. So that's, you know, yeah, you're still local.
Oh, sure.
And that's when you were at Dell, you sort of figured out that's not what you wanted to be doing. And that's sort of when you started moonlighting in comedy. Is that about right?
Well, it's close. What's funny is I realized as far as working for the man goes, I had a pretty good gig. Like, we were part of a group. They called them the Dellware Gurus. Anytime that somebody was out of their depth on helping somebody design like a workstation or a high-end gaming rig, or if somebody called up saying, hey, I'm going to build an ISP, I need to, you know, network, all this stuff, they would escalate the call to our group, which meant that to third-party vendors, you know, let's say your iOmega or Zip or whatever. God, this is so dorky. they would come in and be like, we think you should recommend the Zip Drive. And they would give us all Zip Drives. So you got a lot of free loot doing this kind of gig. And in my mind, I was like, look at me. I'm on a fast track. I'm in my early 20s. I'm already part of this elite group for computer nonsense or whatever. But it was as though it was, I don't know, like this appendage that I couldn't get rid of. every Wednesday night, I would go out and perform for tips, basically. You know, basically, I'd get on for 20 minutes, pass the hat at the Electric Lounge, and then come home. And Thursdays were always, you know, I'd be a zombie, but whatever. And what happened was I got a side gig for a company named PC Order. And it was a show, I remember it so clearly, out on a boat, and they were flush with cash. And I did my – I think I only had 40 minutes of material at the time. But I did my show, and somebody who worked at this company sat at the back of the room and just held court. Like, I would do a trick. People would run to the back, and he would be all like, oh, yeah, no, that trick, that's done by this. And, you know, it's like, oh, I grew up in the circus, so I know that this is because of that or whatever. And he just said – he was like an institutional spoiler. And it occurred to me, I was like, what causes somebody to be that guy who sits in the back of the room and just does nothing but take a giant dump on everything that the performer says? And it occurred to me that this is somebody who knows things but never got credit for it. This guy's one chance to shine is so that he can feel powerful in the reflected glory of whatever it is they watched. And I realized that I projected myself forward. I was like, okay, well, 10 years from now, let's say I'm in my early 30s, you know, what if they had a Dell corporate picnic and they had a magician and the guy got up and did all the things? I was like, I don't think I could stop myself from being a guy in the back of the room holding court. I think that would be the only thing that would make me feel powerful. I think that's the only thing that would make me feel like I had control over the situation. And so I realized, I was like, I don't ever want to become that. I don't ever want to be that guy who wondered what might have been. And around this same time, Dell gave me a raise. And I think I was like $28,000 to $33,000 or something. But it was like I looked at the paycheck and I was like, holy crap. This is grown-up money. And then I realized this is how it happens. This is how you end up doing something you hate for the rest of your life, is that the money just gets too good. So as a direct result of that raise, I remember thinking, I need to get this magic thing out of my system. You know, I don't need to be good. I don't need to be successful. But I need to purge this out of my body so I don't be that guy in the back of the room wondering what might have been. And so as a direct result of the raise, I was like, hey, man, I'm going to take a year off and try being a magician for a year. And everybody was like, so 1 year, right? I'm like, yeah. And they're like, well, we'll see you in a year, Brushwood. And 1 year later, I had made crap money, but I saw how it could work. You know, it's like you peek back just enough to see how the Matrix works. And which, by the way, May of 99, if there's any time to quit your day job, it's when Fight Club and The Matrix are big box office blasts at the time. You know, it's that moment to realize, like, screw you with your cubicle lifestyle. I'm going to go run off and do whatever it is that makes my heart sore. And so anyway, 2 years later, I'd made it on to The Tonight Show, and Dell's stock had, I don't know, lost 40%. So take that, Dell. Screw you.
the whole thing sounds a little Office Spacey to me.
It is. Oh, which, by the way, same year, 1999, Office Space came out. It was it was a really good time to quit your day job and give your middle finger to the man.
Well, it's funny. Around that time, you know, you talk about the hustle and you talk about the side hustle, and everyone's got their job, and then millennials are known for it now. That's going to be their legacy, right? Is always having one eye on the door, one eye at whatever's next. But really, you know, it kind of started there, where it's like, you know what, I don't have to do this. My grandfather worked for Chevron for 40 years and got a watch and got to retire. But people don't want to do that anymore. They want to actually go out and be creative and do what they want to do. And I think it your story kind of sounds like, you know, you've always been hustling.
Yeah. And, you know, as far as the whole, like, the bad news is we're all in a new age where we realize that none of us are going to be living at the same job forever. And we're all going to have to move. We're all going to have to start over all over again. However, the good news is that's how it always was. We were living under a delusion beforehand, right? That idea of the, I don't know, punch the same button like George Jetson until you're, you know, 65 and then get a gold watch and then immediately die is gone. And I'm okay with that for one. I don't know if that's just me. But I don't know. What was the question again?
I forgot. But tell me about Night Attack. Tell me about the podcast, because I went back and looked at episode zero again today before we spoke. All right. Wanted to talk about you and your partner in this, Justin Robert Young. When did guys start going with their middle names?
So, well, first of all, Justin Robert Young added the middle name specifically because I guess there's some quarterback or sports figure named Justin Young, and he was tired of him being trumped in the Google searches for his name. So he's like, it was an arbitrary decision. He's like, I'm Justin Robert Young as of this day. And sure enough, if you search Justin Robert Young, you'll find the actual co-host on Night Attack. And this is the other thing, right? Is that true art comes out of discomfort, I would suggest, right? So once Scam School launched, and by the way, I had done a few television appearances doing magic tricks. I went on, smiled with a blank stare for 4 minutes and then did my trick and then got off stage. And I was like, man, I want more than that. And so we developed Scam School, which is a whole show where it's like I'm fully engaged with the audience, trying to teach them how to do magic and trickery in order to score free drinks. And something resonated there. It seemed to do well. And meanwhile, I would look at, whether it's a radio personality or a podcast personality, the ability to just turn on a microphone and engage with people one-on-one on a meaningful level. Like, there's legends in the business, like Leo Laporte, who hosts This Week in Tech, could just talk forever and everybody would be engaged. I was like, I wanted to know how to do that. And the most obvious route for me to get to that point was, well, obviously, I need to be terrible at it before I get good, because that's what happened in my stage show, is that I realized that what I needed was practice, and I could go out into the streets of, Austin and perform on the street. And if I was lucky, I would get $50. And if I wasn't, I would learn a lot of lessons. And so I turned on a live camera and started doing a terrible, terrible show called the BB Live Show. That's just me awkwardly shuffling in front of a camera, trying to keep the conversation afloat as a one-man operation. And Justin reached out and was like, hey, man, I should be on there with you. And I was like, yeah, let's have you on. And something clicked. It was interesting. It was fun. It was like hanging out with the person one-on-one. And before I knew it, we had 300, 500 people tuning in live every single Tuesday night. And it's like, well, we should make this a show. And from that, eventually, Night Attack emerged, where I don't want to say that the fan base is a cult, but they're highly motivated. I don't know if that works for you.
If you said that they were cultish, I would not disagree with you.
Let's say they're very passionate individuals. How about that?
That's another way of saying it.
Yeah. So we found ourselves on this other edge, and we realized that on the one hand, it is, by the way, for the record, Night Attack is in every way the most fascinating, the most exciting, also the most terrifying part of every single week. Because as a magician, I love structure. I love starting something at step two, knowing that I'm setting up step seven that will pay off 30 minutes from now. Night Attack is the antithesis of all of that, which is part of why it's like a moth to the flame. It's like, well, what if I didn't have any tricks, I didn't have any structure, I didn't have anywhere to go? It's just me and Justin. And what we say on the air, either lives or dies. And luckily enough, things have resonated with enough people that it continues to happen. But understand, even now, 7 years into it, I'm terrified every Tuesday night of trying to be funny for people on purpose.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it is terrifying. The only thing that I have to offer in any frame of reference is this interview show, right? When you're interviewing someone, you do a limited amount of research on folks, right? And then you have to have a good conversation.
So where are you at? Are you comfy? You need a back rub?
No, not comfy at all. Not comfy at all. But to your point.
And that's it, right? It's like the most important skill you could possibly have is the ability to be comfortable being uncomfortable, because it means that you are stepping outside of your current boundaries. It means you're trying something bigger than you currently are. It's terrifying. And even when it goes bad, it's the best thing you've ever done.
Well, and sometimes isn't that better? Some of the best moments have come out of things that have gone awry with people. You ask them about something, it's like, oh, I didn't want to talk about that.
Yes. Also, the worst moments come from those exact same moments. But it's like, it's that whole, you're just buying scratch offs. It's about the number of at bats, right? It's like if you want to get good at hitting home runs, you have to strike out a lot. The folks who hit the most home runs are the ones who strike out the most because they get at that plate over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, no, it's true, and I think it's interesting. You talk about award winning, and congratulations, by the way, the recent podcast awards.
Yeah, thank you, man.
You guys won.
I got to be honest. So my wife was not there when we won all those podcast awards, and I have to give huge, huge credits to the fine folks over in the Frog Pants Network with whom we were affiliated. They have a daily show called The Morning Stream, and their audience that they call the Tadpool is extremely passionate. And over the last 5 years, there's been a number of times that we've been nominated for the podcast awards, but we never campaigned because we were always up against people that we loved deeply, right? In this case, the stars aligned, and all of a sudden we're up for the podcast awards, and we look, and we're like, there's nobody we're up against that is a problem. And we looked at the other categories. We're like, all of the Frog Pants crowd, they're not up against anyone that we like. It's like, what if we created, you know, a voting block? What if we got together and treated this like a Democratic election, i.e., you know, whoever cares the most buys the vote? Let's make this happen. And it was astonishing that evening at the podcast awards to be there and to watch all the Frog Pants team win award after award after award, and then realize, oh crap, I think that means we won too. and then suddenly to hear them call our name for best video podcast, best mature podcast or whatever, it was startling and astonishing and horrifying. And according to my wife, awful. Apparently I was a terrible person when I grabbed the award and said, screw you, losers.
That's awesome.
Because I didn't know what else to say. I was not prepared for it.
Really? You weren't prepared? You didn't think you had a shot?
No. Like, it literally never occurred to me. It was like three awards in. I was like, wow, man, Brian Ibbett's going up and accepting a lot of awards. Sucks to be you, Brian Ibbett, accepting all those awards, trying to figure out what you're going to say. And then all of a sudden they announce our names. And the first words that come out of my mouth are, screw you, losers. I was like, God damn it.
It's going to remain in forever.
It was
there's your legacy.
I'm a terrible person. I'm a bad, bad person.
Nobody's going to remember that. So it's interesting, too, because I'm sure that along the way you picked up a lot of new fans. And you have – so tell me about the strategy. So you go to nightattack.tv.
Yeah, dude, here's what's exciting, right? Early on, there was a moment that changed my life. We were doing early experiments in the live streams, and we only had, you know, maybe 200 people watching live. And I remember thinking, like, take somebody like a Howard Stern or whatever, where it's like, wow, those people wield unimaginable, terrifying power because they can say a thing and their audience will do something about it. And I was like, what would it be like to have that kind of audience? And I was in the middle of making some joke or other, and somebody made up a fake album cover name or band or whatever. I forget what it was. And I remember thinking, man, what kind of audience would I love to have? And I remember saying, as if I was casting a spell that caused it to happen, I remember saying, huh, you better watch out, because I guarantee you before this is over, somebody in the audience will have made an album cover of that. And sure enough, like 5 minutes later in the chat room, I see a mock-up, a crudely drawn Photoshop of whatever the fake album that we were joking about was. And I realized, like, oh, crap, this is how it happens, is you wish a thing into being. You cast out an invitation. And so, of course, you know, I responded by like, see, told ya. And I showed the album cover. And of course, whoever Photoshopped it together was, you know, felt fulfilled because they were like, oh my God, I just, you know, I made this thing for this guy and this guy's, you know, thanking me or whatever on the air. And it just built from there. And eventually, what started off as a mispronunciation mispronunciation of chat room, me sloppily saying chat realm, and it, I just owned it. And so we started calling them the chat realm, as if they're a magical medieval realm or whatever. And they have become more and more powerful. And so now at this point, it's like as I'm fond of pointing out, we are not the guys causing anything to happen. We are the dumbasses dancing at the top of the mountain, and we're constantly surprised when avalanches keep happening. And so now what's happened is, if you go to diamondclub.tv, these people have created this whole thing. Not only is it a community that digs watching me and Justin make jokes and a few other shows as well, but they're also somebody who understands the need to explain who and what they are. So now when on any Tuesday night, if you want to tune in to Night Attack, go to diamondclub.tv. You'll see kind of a step-by-step guide, like, hi, we're a community who loves to do horse crap and shenanigans. Here's the kind of things that we're into. Here's the document that we are helping to shape for the hosts, Brian and Justin, who will be up any minute now. And by the way, here's the chat room and or whatever. It's amazing to watch everybody self-organize as if it's an independent living organism.
It's pretty fascinating. It's pretty fascinating, right? You know, so my background is in broadcast as well, and I've been very fortunate to work with a lot of different personalities, and I have sort of a term for it. I don't think I coined it. I'm certainly not taking credit for it, but it's command of one's audience, right?
Absolutely. And command is a tricky term. I understand why you would be hesitant, because again, like we serve at the pleasure of chat realm. Chat realm doesn't serve us. However, it's a very symbiotic relationship. Like if either me or Justin is up for an award, for example, like with the podcast awards, you can suggest, hey, proposal, hands up if you think it would be fun for everyone to vote for this and win us an award. And hopefully, you know, that's what resonates. But again, there have been other times, there's been a lot of goofy ideas that Justin and I have had that we've suggested, and it just doesn't resonate.
But see, that's part of it. And when I say command, I don't mean command like you own them or you instruct them to do things. But the command is simply that you have a personality that your audience, who has found you however they find you, resonates with you. And they appreciate what you have to offer. And because of that, they keep coming back. And when they come back, they have that familiarity with you. And there's a loyalty that develops between you and them. And it's not one way. It's two ways. You know,
yes. Well, and I'm thrilled to hear you say that, because that's exactly how I feel. It is definitely a two-way street. Understand that that on, you know, the Brian side of things, Brian gets to propose a bunch of ideas along with Justin, and maybe they'll resonate with the audience. And if they do, you'll do outrageous things. For example, there was a book I released, the Scam School book, around the same time that what do you call it? 50 Shades of Grey came out. And I realized, oh man, there's no chance of me hitting number one on the iTunes store, because, you know, 50 Shades of Grey is this mass phenomenon. And a friend of mine says, oh man, what you should do is next time you release a book, make it look like 50 Shades of Grey. I was like, oh, that's hilarious. Maybe we'll do that. And then the more we talked, it became clear. I was like, wait a minute, maybe you should just write a book like 50 Shades of Grey. And then a few minutes later, he's like, wait a minute, why don't you have your fans each write a chapter of this book that'll be a fake book called The Diamond Club, but will look as if it's the fourth volume of 50 Shades of Grey? And so we proposed the idea, and obviously it resonated. Everybody wrote all this stuff. Basically, we came up with a story that's like, here's a chick. She runs a startup. She gets dumped by her boyfriend, and as revenge, she has sex with anything that'll move. Everybody, here's the names of the main characters. Here's the beginning chapter and the end chapter. You guys, each chapter is just her banging another dude or chick, whatever. And so, sure enough, everybody writes it. They fill it up on Google, and we take like 20 minutes to kind of half edit it. And then we put it up on the iTunes bookstore. At the time that it launched, it hit number three. It actually got ahead, because again, this is the thing. When everybody's in on the joke, it's like, here's the game plan. We'll all buy it for 99 cents at the exact same time. Once it's up there,
that's genius.
Also, everybody give it a 5-star review. And we hit up Reddit. We recorded a video explaining our shenanigan, and enough people thought it was funny. And so it posts it gets up to number three. It gets ahead of one of the 50 Shades of Grey books. And what was amazing is our goal from the very beginning was, let's get somebody who's genuinely a 50 Shades of Grey fan to see our horribly written, crowdsourced internet bang fest. And for one second, buy it for 99 cents and believe that they're seeing the next thing. So what we expected was that enough people would buy it that it would get up in the top 10. We did not expect to hit three. We did not expect to be right behind 50 Shades of Grey. But the biggest thing we didn't expect was everybody giving 5-star reviews. So anybody who had just finished the whole 50 Shades of Grey trilogy, all of a sudden was like, oh, man, I want more. And number four on the list for 99 cents was this book that looked like all the other 50 Shades of Grey. And the reviews were all like, better than 50 Shades of Grey. going on talking about like, oh, steamy action. This is a great book to read in the bathtub. And eventually, the 1-star reviews started pouring in. Glorious moment. We stood shoulder to shoulder with the juggernaut that was 50 Shades of Grey.
That is fantastic. What is the name of the book?
The Diamond Club. As a matter of
fact. Oh, that was okay. That was the Oh, that's great.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, this was we came up with the idea for the Diamond Club. At some point, Justin and I noticed that among our fans of our comedy show, there was some contingent that literally just could never get enough. And we had joked about how if we could, we would sell a Diamond Club membership where you could listen in on all of our private conversations where we would say things that we would instantly regret and never want out in public. And from that, once we expressed that to everyone watching live, they're all like, that's a great idea. Also, we're the Diamond Club. and so now that's where diamondclub.tv came from. And it's a little bit. So if you just search the Diamond Club, you'll see I'm looking at it now. It's got a few hundred reviews. It's 4 out of 5 stars on Amazon. You guys, I don't know, you can be part of it. Head on over to diamondclub.tv. There's a live chat room available 24 hours a day.
I'm gonna totally go check this out. The question I have for you is, how long before this becomes like The Matrix, where it just sort of takes over, like Terminator? You know, you built this beautiful thing.
We're a slow growing virus. part of it that is because Justin and I are like, anytime we come up with any idea, we immediately try to figure out like how to throw that away and come up with something even more stupid. And so, you know, there are episodes of Night Attack that are good, and some that are less good, but the best ones are the ones where it's lightning electricity in a bottle. It's unlike anything I've ever experienced in my entire life.
Well, would you do me a favor? I want you to go look at something, because I went back and looked at episode 0, right? Like I was mentioning, and that was from February of 2014, right?
Oh yeah, that was right as we quit our former network. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you go video, obviously, you know, things are going to change. You have to see how you look. You have to manage that process. You have remarkably stayed very similar. Justin, on the other hand, has changed dramatically. Are you aware of that?
All right, let's talk about Justin's weird. If Justin could, I'm fairly certain he would look like one of the members of ZZ Top. Like he would have a beard down to his testicles and be that would be fine with him. What happens is, Justin, and you're so right, dude. I'm looking back in these right now. I always look exactly the same. Justin evolves like the Vitruvian man over time. He'll have a beard that looks like it's there are times Justin looks like he's got a beard made of bees. There are times Justin looks like he's about to blow himself up on a plane. There are times Justin looks like he's about to give his very first speech to the junior high glee club. I cannot explain Justin's versatility from going exactly from age 12 to age 53 back to age 12.
Well, I was just going to say it's a little bizarre. And by the way, I don't know Justin. He's not here to defend himself. And so please accept my apologies. I'm certainly not trying to call him out on anything. But it is like he's been serving presidential time. I mean, you look at him last February and you look at him now. He's aged dramatically.
Okay, but here's the difference. Is presidential time, you can, you're screwed. You're just now 20 years older. However, Justin has the ability with the whisk of a blade to suddenly be 12 again. I mean, it's unreal.
It's
dude.
All beard. Is that it? It's all beard?
Oh, it's all beard.
Well,
it's all
okay.
Beard.
All right.
Well, because like he grows a beard. First of all, he's got a majestic, like his 5 o'clock shadow is my 4 weeks of growth. Right. And then on top of that, half of it is gray. So all he has to do is shave it off. And all of a sudden it's like, you're 12 again.
That's outstanding. Listen, before I don't have you for too much longer, but I wanted to go back and ask you about something that I'm dying to know, because innovation for what you do and what you have done is really kind of like the buzz. It's a buzzword, but I think it's really cool. You are extremely innovative. With Scam School in particular, how do you craft these scams? Because, listen, you can't just go scour the internet for what someone else has done and go, okay, I'm going to do that only different. This is – you have to manufacture them. You have to create them. Where does that come from?
So early on, it came from, I had read a number of books about bar bets and scams and, generally known magic tricks among youngsters getting started in the craft. And so when I pitched the idea of Scam School, I had maybe 50 ideas. And somebody asked, well, what happens after you run out of ideas? And I remember thinking my model was, of course, was the Mythbusters, because it was like, hey, man, they ran out of urban legends long ago, but they figured out, everything's fan run from now on. Everybody posts on the forums, comes up with ideas, they try them and so on. So I had hoped that that's where I would be. I did run out of ideas, and a number of people, like, oh, my grandpa taught me this trick, or my uncle taught me this trick, or whatever. And, it's self-sustaining for a while. But now Scam School finds itself in the curious position where it's like, it's been around so long. I think we're, 7 years now? And so many viewers, because we're creeping up on like 1.2 million YouTube subscribers, that to my astonishment, surprise, and delight – we're getting approached by like some of the top magic creators in the industry are reaching out to me saying like, hey, man, so I got this DVD. There's 12 effects on it. Can I give you one in exchange for you to mention the fact that I have a DVD or whatever? And it's totally win-win. Scam School has become the marijuana of magic, which is put that on my tombstone. It's like it's the gateway drug that gets people seduced into doing magic and impressing their friends.
Is that how you wound up with the hacking show?
Yes, very much so. As a matter of fact, there's an upper limit to Scam School, right?
Scam School
is very narrow in scope. It's always at the bar. It's always we act like the target is winning a free beer, but it very could easily be getting the girl's phone number or impressing your friends or whatever. It's very deliberate and focused in that regard. When I wrote the idea, the pitch for hacking the system, I remember my starting thesis was, if Scam School had no limits, if you had to crank Scam School up to 11, what would it look like? And I was like, I would teach people how to get away with murder. I would teach people how to burn down a house with household chemicals. I would teach them, all this obviously very criminal stuff. And I wrote up this amazing pitch with my buddy Jason Murphy called The Secret Knowledge of Brian Brushwood. And it was full on. It was a criminal manifesto. And we put it out there. And to our shock and surprise at some, convention of people who make, decide on TV shows, 12 networks were interested. And we're like, okay, I guess that's good. And Nat Geo, of course, had the most compelling argument. And what we loved about them is that they had, this legitimacy. They had this ability, this fact checking, this reputation. Now, the unfortunate side effect of working with National Geographic was we had to dial back some of the obviously criminal elements of the show.
Oh, really? You did?
Worth it. Yeah. Funny how that works. It was amazing, dude. It was, especially because before, in a pre Scam School world, Jason Murphy, my co-host on Hacking the System, was actually my co-writer for some of the earliest TV project ideas that we had back 10 years ago. We would pitch stuff about debunking pseudoscience and the paranormal, busting fake psychics, that kind of stuff. And it's amazing how the echoes of the work we did 10 years ago were able to show up in hacking the system.
So is it easier for you now? You've had some success at this. Is it easier for you to go in and pitch shows? Because I'm sure when you went in and pitched the first one, it you stumbled through it, right?
Oh, sure. Well, what's funny is I remember the very first time I pitched a TV show, it went extremely well. It was for Core TV at the time. Now, of course, they're True TV. And I went in and I just nailed it. And the person who was interested was my champion. You know, every so often, you know, everything aligns and you're like, oh, this person who's asking for a thing got exactly what they wanted. Unfortunately, she left the network to go to Sundance. And now, you know, someone else inherited my project who didn't really get what I was about and did a bunch of things opposite. But I remember at the time thinking like, these are bad ideas. These are not directions I would go. And what they got was a very bland product that they passed on. But I remember being so mad at once everything was over. I remember thinking like, oh man, if it were up to me, we would have done X and Y and Z. And I was like, well, screw these guys. The only reason I didn't, you know, nothing went well is because I didn't know. I didn't have the words. I didn't have the background to say, hey, I know that this is a bad idea. So I basically sat down and made a list of like, what does it take to be the host of your own TV show? And the number one item was you need to have already hosted a show. So you have experience to do, you know, to say, to back up X, Y, and Z. And so that year I happened to have like, I think 20 or 30 shows on the road. And a couple of cameras. So we recorded, you know, we spent the next year doing 20 or 30 episodes of something called Brian Brushwood on the Road, which are these raw little vignettes of life on the road. I don't know how good they are. I know that virtually nobody watched them. But when it came time to pitch Scam School, I was able to point to them and say, here's what I look like on camera. Here's, you know, and I've learned how to tell stories in front of an audience, knowing that the editor needs to be able to cut everything up and all that stuff. And Scam School grew from there, and from Scam School came Hacking the System.
That's amazing. Okay, so what's next? Are you happy with the projects you have right now, or are you working on something else as well? I get the feeling that you're the kind of guy that can never really sit still.
Bada bing bang! We have... Yeah, no, last year was the first time. So understand, last year was the biggest year professionally of mainstream media that in my entire life. Up until last year, I was mainly touring, and I would do a little bit of, you know, Scam School on the side. I would do NSFW show, which later became Night Attack. I would do a little bit of the Weird Things podcast. I would do a little bit of this Cord Killers podcast with Tom Merritt. But then last year, all at once, in January, it was, hey, Tom, let's go fully independent. Let's drop from the network. Let's you and me do a whole show about telling people how to cut the cord, to ditch cable and watch all of their content on Hulu, Netflix, Amazon Originals. So we did that. 2 months later, I was like, hey, Justin, what say we go independent? Let's get everyone to go to patreon.com/nightattack and support you and me being funny on the internet every Tuesday night. And so that happened. And then on top of that, it's like, Andrew Main, let's do a show where we talk about, you know, we don't believe in Sasquatch, but we think he's completely awesome. Let's do a whole show about weird things called Weird Things. And so we take all these public. And then after this giant leap, and around the same time, also I turned around to some other folks that was like, hey, let's take over production of Scam School as well. Around the same time, we get word that's like, hey, so anyway, National Geographic wants you to do 10 episodes of Hacking the System. And I was like, great, let's do all of that. Flash forward to late July of last year, and I'm at the doctor's office explaining like, hey, is it normal to not be able to feel your fingers?
But
I don't seem to be able to feel my fingers. And he's like, it's stress. I'm like, no, it can't be stress because like stress is something, you know, fake. This is a real thing, though. I can't feel my fingers. And it's at any rate, in 2014, I may have taken it on a little bit more than I should have. And in 2015, I'm thrilled that 4 months, 5 months into it, slowly easing into more work right now.
So wait a minute. I'm fascinated by this. So had you ever felt anxiety and stress before that?
Sure.
Like, no, at that level, though. I mean,
never at that level. And that was the big thing, is like everything was stress of the moment. Here's the thing, right? When you get booked in West Virginia and you are backstage and you're going to do your 45-minute show and you hear the audience and you think to yourself, I don't know that I'm a match for this audience. I don't know if it's going to work. It's like, well, I'll do the best I can and I don't have any choice because I'm on in 3, 2, 1, go. And you walk out on a stage and you do your act, and halfway through your act, you think, oh, wow, am I not resonating with these people? This is not going well. I don't think this was a good booking. I don't think I should have taken this. Well, let's file that away for later. And then, you know, and then the show ends and you meet with everyone and you're like, well, you know, I don't know. There was like 20% of the audience that seemed to dig it. Everyone else clearly hated me. But then here's the difference is you get on a plane or you get in the car and now you're in North Carolina and none of that matters. It's a little bit different when it's television, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, especially because it was not an option last year, you know, as we made this giant leap to take these podcasts independent, I had an obligation to keep doing them. I couldn't say, hey, let's press pause on this. And what we ended up doing last year was we were shooting 5-6 days a week, and there was really only Sundays was the only protected day. I said to everyone, I was like, hey, we want to keep doing this. Let's do this on Sundays. And, I'd work 14, 16 hours a day all week long. And then I have half a day off on Saturday. And then Sunday was nothing but a 9-hour rock block of podcasting or whatever, because I didn't want to let down all the other folks who made it possible. And on the one hand, you know, it was emotionally satisfying to do my part for them or whatever. But in my mind, the stress level was an infinite well. In my mind, it was like, yeah, no, whatever. I could do everything. I'm Brian Brushwood, whatever. Don't worry about it. And it was a strange, strange thing to look at it as if it was a bizarre medical condition and say, like, I cannot feel my fingertips. I wonder why that is. Let me go to the doctor. And the doctor's like, anything stressful happening in your life? And you casually say, like, I don't know. I'm hosting my own TV show for the first time, took 3 podcasts independent, maybe working 60, 70 hours a week. I guess no, nothing's weird. And the doctor is looking at me like, what are you, high? What is this? This is crazy.
Just out of curiosity, how do you manage it?
I mean, nowadays, it certainly helps that I've had a few months off.
Okay. All right.
It was a difficult time. You know, you only if you end up doing what I do or have done for a living, the only way you sign up for that is if you're dumb enough to think that you're immortal. And the good news is you spend a vast majority of your working career thinking you're immortal. And then at some point, you buy one too many responsibilities, and you discover that you're not immortal. and so you know, this has been like, I am just now in May of 2015 coming out of the shell of backing out from you know, I don't know, like looking at death in the eye, being like, ah, screw you, death, I can do anything. And then death is like, yeah, your fingers can't work anymore. And you're like, let me back up. And so here we are 5 months later of a stable schedule. And it's like, death, you want to dance again? Let's go.
And the gift of prioritization, right?
Yes. And also, it's not just the gift of prioritization. It's definitely the gift of familiarity, like Night Attack was taken independent literally, 60, 90 days before I went out to L.A. And we had to just after we set out west and announced to our followers, come with us. There's a magical land of independent podcasting just around this horizon. And then just after we left, I had to turn to my cohort, Justin, and be all like, by the way, I'm going to leave to L.A. for like 8 months. Bye. So we had to kind of upend everything, and I didn't want to leave Justin in a lurch. So I found myself, very obligated to take what normally would have been recharge time and instead dedicate it to, you know, building up our online fan base and taking them along for the ride. But it was I ain't going to lie, man. That was difficult. That's hard. I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
If you're thinking about taking on a TV show just while you launch two or three independent podcasts, allow my tombstone to say don't.
Perfect.
Just put that on my tombstone. Just don't.
Perfect. So we've got a crowded tombstone, and the lesson is give up your dreams, kids, because it's not going to work, or it's going to kill you in the process. There you go.
Well, I mean, look, a tombstone. You know, the question is, what are you going to write on it?
Yeah, no kidding. Well, listen, you want to talk about busy. Here's a lot of follow up for you. So
all right.
Break out your pens because you're going to need it. DiamondClub.tv.
DiamondClub.tv.
That's Tuesday nights.
Yep, that's Tuesday nights. That's where you can see all of our podcasts live as they happen. They got reruns on there. The Weird Things podcast, which is all about pseudoscientific, crazy paranormal, cryptid stuff. You got Night Attack, which is our comedy show. You got Cord Killers. If you're somebody who hates Comcast or Time Warner Cable, I apologize if either of those are a sponsor of Playboy Radio.
No.
And you can you figure out how to cut the cord and watch what you want, when you want, on whatever damn device you want.
All right. And Night Attack TV, that's where you can follow the podcast and everything else.
Correct.
For Brian's site, schwood.com.
Yeah,
where there's everything Brian, which is great.
Yeah, right. That's the last part of Brushwood, Brushwood, just the wood part.
Yeah.
I came up with that like 20 years ago, and now there's a wooden sunglasses company called Schwood that seems to be circling like buzzards around my domain. And I'm like, get lost! I was Schwood before you were a twinkle in that sapling's eye!
Well, are they sponsors of yours yet?
Not yet.
Oh, come on. Seriously?
Write them!
Come on now.
In all seriousness, there's actually two manufacturers of wooden sunglasses. One is named Schwood. The other is named Brushwood USA. So apparently there's like a dad and a dad fighting over my name in a segment that I never thought I would have an interest in.
Well, listen, that sponsorship sells itself. So, and then to follow you on Twitter, it's at Schwood. Same thing.
Schwood, S-H-W-O-O-D.
Yeah, which is great. Hey, Brian Brushwood, thank you very much for the time today. Congratulations on all the awards, the podcast in particular, because it's awesome. It's very funny, and everyone should check it out.
Heck yeah, Josh. Thanks for having me on, man.
Hey, Brian.
Yep.
Awesome.
Dude, no, you're awesome.
You're awesome.
No, your shoulders are muscular. Why don't we talk that way? We should be all like, hey, bro, you're looking very muscular. Nice abs.